telling my kids that that's the position I was in. Imagine telling your kids that, that you were thinking of taking your life and that. I remember sitting down with them and said, listen, I'm telling you because I want you to be open and honest. At some point you're going to get low and you're going to feel bad in your life or whatever.
Yes, welcome back to another episode of More Than a Name. Let's get right into it with our special guest this week. We are sitting down with Stephen Warnock, the former defender who represented clubs such as Liverpool, Blackburn, Aston Villa and Leeds. He made 193 appearances in the Premier League and went to the 2010 World Cup with England, achieving all of this despite breaking his leg three times before the age of 20. Since retiring, Stephen has openly discussed his struggles with depression, revealing during the COVID pandemic that he had mentally planned how he was going to end his life. With the help of friend and therapist Paul Cope, Stephen was able to work back to a life of meaning and feeling content within himself. He now works regularly, and may I say brilliantly, as a freelance broadcaster, giving his expert football opinion to the BBC, NBC, the Premier League, Sky Sports and many more. Stephen Warnock, welcome to More Than a Name.
Thank you for having me.
When was the last time you saw this one?
Do you know what? I actually can't remember. And that's the thing, when you fall out of football or you walk away from a changing room or when you retire, sometimes you do lose touch with people. So when Youngie messaged me to come on, I was absolutely made up because it was a chance to meet up and see each other again and, yeah, have a good catch up.
We've been talking a lot about your current broadcasting work. It sounds and it seems like you really enjoy it.
I absolutely love it. There's always a moment in your career where you think, what's next? I remember being on the bus when I was at Blackburn and I was sat with Jason Roberts, who was probably around about 32, 33 at the time. I might be wrong. He might have been a little bit younger. But he said to me, the biggest thing you've got to do is plan when you retire. And I was thinking at the time, I was like 20, 24, 25. And I was thinking, I don't really need to plan for when I retire. And he said, you'll start to worry when the paychecks don't come in. And it didn't hit me until I finished about that conversation. I remember thinking, like, I should have planned more. But I was also in a little bit of a fortunate position that when I was coming towards the end of my career at Bradford, I had a phone call from my then football agent saying, Five Live wanted me to go in the studio and have a chat and do a show. Did a show. It obviously went well. And then they said to me, we'd like you to come back next week and do another one. Did you enjoy it? And I did really enjoy it. And then they just kept on saying, like, we've got more work for you. We keep on doing this. And then I got a phone call in around about the April time. And this was probably February when I first started doing the stuff. And it was, do you know what you're going to do when, like, next year you're going to carry on playing? And I was like, well, how come? And it was just a case of, we've got enough work for you. If you were to retire, we think we can fill that void for you. And I was driving. I've just picked my kids up from school. I was with my ex-wife in the car and we were driving into Liverpool. I can pinpoint the exact spot where I was on the road as well. And I just went, yeah, I'll retire. And he was like, no, you need to think about this. And I went, no, that's the right thing to do. Because in my head, I remember thinking, if I don't retire now, someone else will get that job and that door might close for me. So a year down the line, someone else might have taken that position, done an incredible job, and they go, oh, no, we don't need you anymore. So I thought that was the perfect time to call it a day. And it was just something that almost fell into my lap that I thought, yeah, I can do this.
We should talk Villa. Is there a fullback alliance?
Always a fullback alliance, especially when you're at Villa, because yeah. I think the manager at the time, he had it in for the fullback, so I think a little bit. So, I remember when Warnie came, I'd find myself injured in pre-season. When I got back, Warnie had signed. We'd signed James Collins and we'd signed Richard Dunn all at the same time. So coming back into training and into the squad, I'm waiting for an opportunity to get back in the side. And these boys didn't give me an opportunity. So obviously Warnie signing was brilliant, but I had to sit on the sidelines for a while.
That was my fault. I was playing left back.
Yeah, that's where I was before you turned
yeah,
up.
No, yeah, true.
But loved it when Warnie was around. Always had a good laugh, mate, didn't we, in training?
Yeah,
it was a great dressing room. It really was. We had a good laugh.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, when I came in, it was nice because I'd already met you at England, and then I knew a couple of the other boys from England as well, and that was one of the appealing things to go there, was that I knew it'd be comfortable walking into the changing room. What I didn't realise was the manager was hard work, and I was used to structure, a training plan, being fit, being disciplined. And I came in and suddenly it wasn't that at Villa. And I remember walking in thinking, how are these guys such a good team? But it was like the players within the changing room, wasn't it? And it's not being disrespectful to the manager, because he knew how to make certain players tick. And it was Martin O'Neill, for those who are listening. But it was some players needed an arm around them. Some needed more than a... There was certain times where he got players' characters wrong and he'd make a bit of a mess of it. I don't know if you remember it, the Christmas one where he pulled everyone in for the chats around about December time. And I remember walking out the changing room and, I was sat in the changing room and someone walked in and went, Gaffer wants to see you. And I was like, what's this? And he was like, oh no, it's the mid-season reviews. And I remember distinctly you saying to me, don't listen to a word he says. And I was like, thinking, as I'm walking to his room, thinking, why? And then I get in there and he goes, so how do you think you're doing? And I was like, flying. I think I'm doing really well. Like, really enjoying my time. And he was like, right, let me tell you how it's really going. And he just absolutely tore me to smithereens. And I was like, I walked out lower than the snake's belly. And my career at Villa after that for the next 6 months just went nosedive.
But bearing in mind, we're like second, third in the league at this time.
We're flying.
Warney's played every game, knocking on the door of the England squad.
I was in it, yeah.
England squad. So he's going into that meeting thinking, you know, this could only be positive. I'm new to the club. Plenty of clean sheets. We're flying high in the league. And he comes out and he's like,
yeah, the old reverse psychology.
How did Martin read your character wrong there? Because you all took it differently, didn't you?
Yeah, I think you do take it different, but I think it was the reverse psychology of go and prove me wrong. Well, I didn't need that, because I was thinking, well, all you have to do is just say to me, carry on doing what you're doing. That's all he needed to say, being very happy. But the thing was, it was like mixed messages, because like John Robertson was kept on saying to me, like, you're doing great, you're flying. And I was thinking, well, which one am I listening to here? Well, the manager's the one with the most important voice in the room. So you sort of listen to him. And I just thought, but the other thing that was getting to me was, I don't know whether you remember that one where he was talking about Nicky Shorey. And like, Nicky had signed before me, probably, was it 2 years or the year before? And he'd signed from Reading. And I remember the lads telling me a story where he was saying to Nicky Shorey, did you leave your legs in Reading because you can't run? And I remember thinking, like, what is this guy all about? I'm not that type of person. I like, if someone's doing well, I like to tell them they're doing well, because you just keep building the confidence, don't you? I just took a massive confidence dip from it. But I think if I'd have, in modern game, the way things are set up now, with a psychologist, I'd have just gone, right, go and sit with the psychologist and he'd explain things and you'd have thought things differently and you'd probably change your mindset. But we didn't even have a psychologist there at the time.
I think it was around about the same time that Warney joined the club, and sitting in the, I wasn't actually there, but Ginge tells it well, sitting in the meeting for, you know, tactics or lack of tactics. So Danny's just said, listen, what do we do at set pieces? New to the club, not trained really yet. Like, is it zonal? Is it man to man? He's gone, listen, you two big lumps, I've signed you to go and head the ball. So when that ball comes in the box, you two go and head it. And that was it. And that basically kind of summed it up, really.
That summed the tactics up, and it summed everything up. Because I remember the other one where I think it was you and Millie were saying, like, we don't do enough fitness work. Mm. And he was like, it's not my job to make you fit. He went, if you want to go and do running, get on a treadmill after training, or go and run around the pitch, you work it out. He went, I'm here to make sure that you're, like, I pick the team and I make sure everyone's signed and whatever. And it was like, my word. Different. It was completely different to what I was used to, because I'd come from organisation under Mark Hughes at Blackburn, then Sam Allardyce was at Blackburn as well, where tactically everything is like, there's no stone left unturned.
Before one season, all the squad had gone away, and I'd questioned pre-season training. Don't know if you remember this. I went up to the fitness coach and I said, I could do some more sharper stuff. We're doing a lot of long stamina runs. And I said, can we start doing some short, sharp work? Because as a fullback, I need Ashley Young running at me, chopping and me trying to stop shots and crosses. So we finished the training. But obviously, in the meantime, the fitness coach has gone over to Martin O'Neill and told him, oh, by the way, Young, he says that. So he's got us all in together and he's just tried to make me look stupid in front of the group. So he's going, oh, Luke, you know more than we do you?
Oh,
apparently Luke's going to take training from now on, so in front of the whole group. And to be fair, Richard Dunn stood up for me and he said, why can't you just listen to his opinion? Like,
yeah.
He's an experienced player. Like, why can't you just listen to what he's saying? And so then I'm in the shower after training and John Robertson comes up to me and he says, Luke, do you want to come to Ireland tomorrow? And I'm thinking, well, it's not my decision, is it? Like, I'm a player here. You tell me what you want to do. So I didn't really reply or respond to it. Came in the next day and all the boys travelled away. But luckily for me, training pre-season hadn't been great, I didn't think. I trained with Kev for a week while they were in Ireland. Ireland was like a stag do.
Yeah.
And I got so fit. So Martin O'Neill ends up leaving before the first game of the season. I've been training with Kev. Kev gets the job and I start the season. It's just
crazy, isn't it? Bonkers.
It's crazy. Times have changed, right? And this show is a lot about unique environments, overcoming pressure. Am I right in saying your debut for Villa was against Birmingham?
Yeah.
At St Andrews.
Yeah.
What a start.
Should have been sent off. Yeah, it was, I mean, that was one of those things where I'd played in games with Liverpool and United and I played in Merseyside derbies and I was like, I was really excited to play in that game. Because the first game we played, I think it was Fulham at home. I was on the bench and I was furious thinking, just come to the team. Like, why am I not starting? And then he pulled me in midweek and he just said, listen, you will be starting next week. And then when we got to St Andrews, straight away you could feel outside the tension, people throwing stuff at the bus. And it was like, phew, here we go. And then when you get on the pitch, you just get that sense of like the tackles were flying in. I think it was around about 80 minutes odd, I flew into a tackle off a yellow card. Don't know how I didn't get sent off for a second yellow. And I remember thinking that was lucky. And I think Gabby scored late on, didn't he, to win it. But it might have been different had I been sent off.
I might have got a game the next week if you'd been sent off.
Sorry, mate.
You were hoping for red there, weren't you?
Yeah. But now what an introduction, because I think sometimes that's what you need as well, is a difficult challenge. And then suddenly you get a clean sheet. Everyone's talking about how well like we'd sort of gelled straight away. And listen, Ginge and Dunny were great players. It was quite easy to play alongside Dunny. If you anyone watched Dunny, he was an unbelievable player.
Do you have a favourite Gabby or Ashley Young story?
But I'd never, ever seen anything like it when we were training and it was freezing cold. And they had like jackets on past the knees, like trench coats. And I was thinking, what is going on here? They gotta get away with anything. But Gabby used to go away. I think he went to Miami, Vegas, and New York in a year, didn't he? During the season, which was international.
Incredible
breaks.
Run.
And I was thinking, how's he doing this? How's he getting the time to go here? But again, Martin absolutely loved him, so he gave him the time to do it. But the big thing was, and it was the most important thing, they were our important players on the pitch, weren't they?
It was the first time that I ever went into a dressing room having signed for a club. And the young lads were running the dressing room. Yeah. I'd never seen it before in my life. Generally, you'd go to a club and the senior pros, the senior boys are the ones that were conducting things. I walked in there and it was mental. It was like a circus in the changing room. And Gabby and Youngie were pulling the strings for days off with the manager if we won at the weekend and stuff like that.
That's who you turned in, wasn't it? If we wanted a day out or a night out and or organise something, you wouldn't send one of the senior boys. Like Stannard send... Then wouldn't he? Send Gabby and Youngie in to sort it out. It's incredible.
So Liverpool, Blackburn, Villa, Leeds, there are more. Some of the clubs you played for. You went to a World Cup with England, and yet you've spoken about feeling like a failure when you first look back on your career. Do you understand now where that view came from?
I've talked about this before, but then I've like thought about it more and more. So if you flipped my career on its head and turned it the other way around and say you start at Burton and things like that, and then you go to Bolton and you work your way up and you end up at Liverpool, you go, wow, what a career. But if you look at Ricky Lambert, and Ricky Lambert was one who started at Blackpool, then he went to Bristol Rovers, then he went to Southampton, then he went to England, you go, wow, what a career he's had. He's just done it the other way around. And I remember looking at it thinking, I've gone up first and then down, whereas Ricky's gone almost down and then up. And you go, well, there's no right path and no wrong path, but I've gone to a World Cup, I've played for Liverpool, I've played for Aston Villa, I've played in cup finals, and you go, wasn't that bad. I think the big thing was just my time at Villa knocked me for six massively. I lost a lot of confidence, probably should have had, and this is probably where it comes from more than anything. The last game of the first season, when the World Cup squad was announced, I got injured against Blackburn in the last game of the season, did my ankle, and I should have had an operation. But I came back from the World Cup on such a high because I've made it into the World Cup squad, and then came back and we went to Portugal, didn't we? We were in the infamous trip in I can't even remember where it was, but it was in Portugal somewhere. And it was one of those moments where when we were there, I was like, I should have just bit the bullet and had an operation. But my thing was I didn't want to spend 4 months out the game because I'd just come back off a World Cup and I was on a high. But what happened for the rest of my career, if you probably look at it, was I'd probably have spells where I'd play for a month or two, then I'd break down for a month. Same ankle every single time, and I was having jabs in it. I was having sugar injections in it, trying to strengthen the tendons and the ligaments and everything. It never worked, and I should have just at some point gone, the best thing for me to do here is have the operation. I could never push off. Like I can't. My ankle's not great now. If you ask me to jump, everything comes from my left foot, whereas all my power used to come from my right foot. So whenever I used to sprint or jump, everything was from my right foot. And I had to train myself to jump off my other foot. It just wasn't right.
When Warnie, I heard him say before that he felt disappointed with his career, I was shocked by that, if I'm honest. Breaking your leg 3 times before you're 20 years of age and having any type of football career would have been a bonus. But to go on to have the career you've had in the Premier League and going to a World Cup, you know, you should have been loads more proud of that than you probably... Maybe it's because you went to a World Cup and then the years subsequent after that probably went downhill a bit too quick than you'd wanted to.
100%. And I think you're right with the leg breaks. If I look back at it now, to make one game was impressive after the back of 3 leg breaks. But I think the way your career goes, everyone's greedy in life though, aren't they? Once you get to the highest point, you think, oh, this is sustainable. I want to stay here forever. And it's not, and it's very difficult. And I think, when I look back now, the proudest thing I ever did was get over 3 leg breaks and play football. I mean, that is the proudest thing I've ever done. I mean, I remember, and this is where you've got to put things into context in your own head and look back at things and think, wow, I'm really lucky there. The second time I broke my leg, so just to give people a little bit of depth in it, I broke my leg in first game out of school in the academy away at Tottenham. And I used to be like a left winger. I used to be like very quick and... the ball was coming over my shoulder. I put my right leg down, planted it, keeper came out and went through my leg and it just shat, like went, like broke. And then I came back after 9 months playing Leeds away, playing left wing again, ran past someone, put my right foot down, he kicked through the side of it and it collapsed. Now, when I did the second one, I was in hospital and the doctor, well, the surgeon came in, he said, you'll never play football again. He said, I'm so sorry to tell you that, but I've got to tell you that now. And then after the surgery, when I woke up, I remember just waking up and like sort of the doctor being there, but I had Steve Highway was there. My mum and dad were there. And he said, listen, I've done a 10 out of 10 job. He said, like, there is a chance you will play again. And I remember thinking, right, well, if there's like the slightest of chances, then I'm going to give it my all. But the other thing that happened was Liverpool gave me a 3-year deal while I was in hospital, a professional contract, and just said, listen, we'll give you the time. We'll give you every bit of support that we can give you. But it was very difficult. There was times where I was like going out, getting pissed all the time, like feeling sorry for myself. That's part and parcel of it. You have those moments, but it's about the people around you who then support you to get you through it. And like I say, to come back from that. But the funny thing is like wherever you go and play and whatever manager looks at you, they don't realise what you've gone through. They don't realise the struggles that you've had to get there or fans or anything like that. There's only you and probably the closest people to you, which is probably the physio, the doctor, and then your family who realise how tough it is.
And please say, if you don't want to talk about it, at this time as well, did you lose a couple of friends?
Yeah, I lost my best friend when I was 14. So he was... We were all meant to go to this party at a local pub. It was for a friend of ours, a girl, and she had a party there. Young kids being young kids, everyone was like trying to get alcohol. I didn't go because I had a football game the next day. So I missed out on this party, and the pub was on a railway crossing, and he's come out obviously drunk and whatever, wandered down the railway path and then got hit by a train, and he died at 14. He was my best friend, and that was very, very tough to take for a long time because we were inseparable. And then at the age of 17, one of my friends went out on a night out and then on the way home crashed his car, wrote it off on a motorway and toppled it and things like that. And that it's never a nice thing. It's when you're growing up, they're the hard things in life. And they're the things that have really scarred me later on in life. when you asked me before, have I seen Youngie or have I seen anyone? I don't really get close to people because I fear that, losing people. So when we were at the World Cup in South Africa, my auntie who, so my mum used to be a nurse and she worked nights and I used to spend a lot of time with my aunties. My auntie got cancer just before we went to the South Africa and I didn't want to go. And I remember going to see her and she was like, you've got to go. It's like one of those things. And I remember getting back from South Africa and she just come back off holiday and she wasn't in a great way. Went to see her and I said, listen, I'm going to go on holiday for a week with the family and whatever. And she was like, yeah, I'll see you when you get back. Literally landed out in Spain, got a message to say, you need to come home, flew home and she passed away. But they're the closest people to me. So I find even now relationships very difficult to get close to people because I'm scared of what might happen. So even when, and this is one of the biggest guilts I've ever got is like when Stillian got injured, it's like I couldn't go and see him in hospital because I felt worried that he was going to pass away or, and you just get that element of, I don't know what to do in them situations. It scares the life out of me.
Well, thank you for sharing. Stillian actually said this to us. We were talking about having you on and he hadn't actually heard about what you've been going through. When Luke says, I haven't seen that person for years now, I just assumed that the football community stuck together.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know whether you find this, but when you're in a changing room, you're very much in the changing room and you're all buzzing on messages and things like that. When you leave that changing room and you go and sign for another club, and I had quite a few clubs, so I'd jump into another changing room and that changing room almost gets parked and you're almost like, well, you're not part of us anymore. So you go into the next changing room and then that becomes your immediate group of friends and family. And then it just keeps on going. And then it gets to a point where you move out the last changing room and then you go, oh, I'm on my own now. Where do I go from here? And now I'm in a changing room of the media. So I've got commentators, co-commentators, people who I'll see on a date, like on a basis where I go to a ground and I walk in, and I feel like, oh, there's me mates. But you've lost the community of all of the ex-footballers. But it's strange when you see people and you meet up with them, it feels like you've never not seen them.
You say that.
Said it then.
Yeah.
Just see Warney down the road there before we started and it's like, I saw him last week, you know, it's just the way it is. But the way he explains it there about when you leave a dressing room, it is really strange how you can just lose contact. But again, when you do see those people again, you remember the times that you've shared and it feels like last week that you've been together.
Yeah. I mean, I try my best and on social media to, if I see someone doing something, I'll message them and try and reconnect with people. And I feel like more so than ever over the last year or so, I've tried my best to do that. But there's certain people that you can't or don't contact you or don't want to get in touch or whatever. And that's part and parcel of football and things like that. But I'd love to have like a reunion. I think we talked about it, didn't we, last year? And it never came out, did it? It never happened. We were all going to go to London and have a night out, all the ex-Villa players, and it didn't happen. And I can't remember. I think I went away somewhere. So I was like, I wouldn't have been able to make it anyway. And I was gutted. I was thinking, I want to see all the lads and have a night out.
Is Gabby social sec? he's in charge.
I don't know, actually. I think it could be Siddy or Smudge.
I think it was Siddy and Stan that started.
Yeah, Stan would have been as well.
Luke grew up Spurs fan.
Yeah.
Signs with Spurs as a young player. You grew up on the Kop, right?
Yeah.
And you're at Melwood as a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
What was it like in that era and who was there?
It was amazing because it was the old Melwood and the old building. And I just remember thinking, obviously, I used to drive past it as a kid thinking I'd love to one day be able to train there and things like that. An amazing place to go we used to be different. I mean, the kids train every night now, but it was a Tuesday night, Thursday night, and then you'd play on a Saturday or a Sunday. I think there's an element of when you get into a club, or I certainly thought this, and maybe this is why I made it as a footballer. I was like, this is it now. This is the start of it. And this is how I get into the first team. There was never any doubt in my mind that I was going to play for Liverpool. I never doubted myself at all. I always thought mentally I'll be stronger than everyone. And it's funny that I say that now because I think I actually, I started off as a youngster, so resilient, so tough. And as I got older, I got weaker and weaker. And I remember thinking, but there's no outside influences. And that's the difference. But to be able to stand on the Kop and then to go and play for your boyhood team is like the absolute dream. Like, my mum's a red, my dad and my brother are both blues. So I used to go to Anfield one week And then the week after, I go to an Everton game because my dad had three season tickets for me and my brother and him. And I used to sit and support the away team. But it was just the best time. And then when I was, I think I was around about 15, you know, where you have your work experience in school, I got to go into Melwood and train with the first team for 2 weeks. And it was just the best thing I'd ever done. I think my dad still got them, but I was in the loft in their house. I was Steve McManaman's boot boy for 2 weeks, and he gave me a pair of, like, they were Umbro Specialis. He'd taken the Umbro off them, off the sides, because he was trying to get a boot deal at the time. And I ended up signing with Umbro off the back of that, because I was so obsessed.
I was just about to say, you used to always wear Umbro Specialis.
But that was what it led me to, because I was like, well, Steve McManaman wears them, I've got to wear them. And then I ended up contacting Umbro, knew a couple of guys there, and I was like, could I get some boots? And they were like, oh yeah, we'll sort you out. And it was just like, just Umbro Specialis though. Loved them.
Did you both know when you were accepted by the fan base, whatever that means, especially for your local club? Is there a moment when you think, okay, I'm in now, I'm one of them?
I don't think so. I don't think you can, because a couple of bad games on the run and your form's dipping and it's hard to get out of that. So I don't think you ever take it for granted. I think it's game by game. You're just trying to do your best and forge your way. I don't think you can ever take anything for granted in football, because if you take your eye off the ball and your performance is slipped, you're in danger of falling into a bad run of form.
People are so fickle. Like they've got such short memories and of what goes on. I think it's very difficult when you're a young lad as well, coming through. I think you're almost the easiest one to replace, or the easiest one to sell on. That's where it's certainly felt for me as well. I think the biggest thing I always felt when I was playing at Liverpool was just a massive pressure. Like it's like a pressure like no other. And there's a lot of talk around signings now, and I just think you've got no idea what you're walking into at times. And I don't think fans realise the pressures that are on players when they play for huge football clubs, is that there's an expectancy and it's like no other. So the mental side of the game now is the hardest thing. But I think being accepted by your fan group is a very, very difficult one, because form's very temporary.
When you're a young lad at Liverpool, you've had the three leg breaks to get over. How did you get a loan to a championship club and championship level straight away? Normally, if you've not been seen very often, it would be like a League Two or a National League, but you've gone straight in at the championship level.
So we played Bradford in a game in the reserves, and I played centre mid that night, and Nicky Laws, who's the manager of Bradford, was there. And we got back on I played really well in the game, and I think I'd been back about 4 months, 5 months, and I was getting fitter and stronger all the time. And we were on the bus on the way home, and Hugh McCauley, who was the reserve team manager at the time, he just went, have you got a minute? So I was like, yeah. He went, how do you think you did tonight? I thought, like, I'm getting there. I feel like I'm getting fitter and stronger. He went, you f***ing must be. He said, the manager just rang from Bradford. He wants you to go on loan tomorrow. And I was like, great. And that was how I got the move, was just by chance of playing them, played well in the game. I can't remember who played for them, but there was senior players within their team in centre midfield, and I played well against them. And I remember thinking, like, oh, I can hold my own there. And I think I ended up signing about 3 or 4 days later for them. And that was how I got the move. And I was like absolutely over the moon.
And then you was off and running.
Yeah, I felt like I was, yeah. Because I felt like the big thing for me was when I made my debut at Bradford, I played left back in the game. And he said to me, listen, I'm just going to play your left back in this game because I know you can play there. But after that, you're going to play centre mid. And we played Walsall away. And that was my debut. And I played well in the game. And I remember thinking, I can play at this level. Straight away thinking, right, I can play at this level. Now, can I play at Premier League? And it just took its time to get there. But I just remember thinking, yeah, I'm more than happy at this level.
Yeah, I listened to you speaking about, obviously not a pleasant memory for you, but being left out of the Champions League final and the way that came about.
I mean, I get absolutely hammered for this now on social media, because everyone's like, oh, you're just bitter and like let it go and stuff like that. And I'm like, all right, okay, yeah, let the biggest game in world football go. And you're like, there's a way of dealing with things. And I think there was, I look at it back at it now and I just think, I still don't think Rafa Benitez handled it well. I really don't. So we were playing AC Milan in the final. We played Aston Villa on the last day of the season, and I played the game. I don't know whether I finished it. I can't even remember. And I remember we had a 2-week period from the last game until the Champions League, and it was like, right, we're in training for that 2 weeks, and we build up to the Champions League final. And then 3 days before, we were due to fly to Istanbul, and the squad list goes up, and my name's on the squad list. I'm thinking, brilliant, biggest game in football. You're either starting or you're on the bench. That's what you knew. Usually when a squad list goes up now, there's probably 3 or 4 players carried in case there's sickness, illness or injury. And then it wasn't. It was literally a squad of 18. That was the bench as well. And I was thinking, wow, this is going to be incredible. And came out the building, literally showered as quick as I could, ran out, told all the family, got all the tickets sorted, trying to book flights, getting all the flights booked, and then got a phone call a few hours later to say they'd made a mistake on the squad list and that I wasn't in the squad. But it wasn't Rafa who called me, it was the assistant manager. And I just always remember thinking, like, how can you make such a big decision in someone's career and not have the bottle to tell them yourself? I just think it was a lack of respect.
Going back to what you said earlier about being a local lad and being the easiest one to perhaps...
100%.
That's a case of you being left out because you're the local boy, the youngest in the group.
Yeah, I was an academy graduate, and I've been told by other people within the squad who were close to the player that Josemi, who was the right back, Spanish right back, he'd been out all year. I don't know if he'd had an ACL or an Achilles injury, something. He'd been out anyway, but he played that game against Villa. It was his only game of the season. And he went up and kicked off and knocked on the door. And I was the youngest player within the squad.
And there was a big monetary value to being in that squad. Am I right?
It was 100 grand, even if we lost the game. But it was 200 if you won. And I was thinking, I could do with that. Yeah. I mean, I was a youngster at the time. Yeah, and I was thinking, like, no matter how much money you've got or what you do, it's like that side of it. But also as well, it was more so the fact of you want to play be involved in the Champions League final. And that was just after the game. You won't see me on many pitches, if any. I was just stood at the back thinking, in my head straight away, I was thinking, I'm out of here.
Surely you want to reward the local lad, you know, the lad that supports the club.
Yeah, well, from an academy point of view as well, if you get an academy graduate and you put him in the Champions League final squad, what are you telling players that you're going to sign or bring through the academy? There's a pathway. When you're after success, that goes out the window, doesn't it? Because you're just so single-minded on the outcome of the game. You're not thinking of the long term. And probably rightly so, because the manager might not be there for that long term.
If you did have one question for him now, then what would it be?
Why didn't you call me? Why didn't you do it? And simple as that. And I'd love to know the reason why.
Jamil Qureshi, am I getting that name right?
Qureshi. One of the guys who I should have stayed in contact with when I left Blackburn. So Jamil's a sports psychologist. Jamil was brought into Blackburn to help us when we were down at the bottom and change the mindset of players and perhaps how they approach it. I've just done a podcast with him talking about it on my podcast about what he looks for when he goes into a changing room. And he says there's 3 ways of looking at it, where you've got a group of players who don't need help because they're already playing well. There's a group in the middle that you feel that you can get more out of. And there's a group at the bottom who are not going to be helped because they're in a position where they're not interested and they don't want to. They want to get out the club. So he focuses on the middle ground. Mm-hmm. And he said one of the things he looks at is that if I can get more out of those players, then I'll improve the squad. And when we met Jamil, we were all driving across from the training ground to Ewood Park, and it was just a case of we're going to meet a psychologist, and all the lads were in the phones to each other. There was a few lads in the car just like, what are we doing here? Why are we going to meet this guy? Like, pointless. And then we met him, sleight of hand, taking watches off people. Suddenly he's got people interested. And the next day you're thinking, he's in the office. I thought, I'll go and have a chat with him. And it was just night and day, how to approach a game, how to look at it. He hypnotised me before one of the games against Fulham, where he came into me room away from Fulham and made me go through the game step by step. And I remember playing the game thinking, that's exactly how I thought of that last night when I was going to sleep. And it was just phenomenal. But then I went to Villa and thought, I know how to do that now, and sort of came away from it. Tried to get back in touch with him, but it was just a case of I didn't buy into it enough, and I should have. I should have realised the importance of him as a psychologist, of how important he was to me.
when you came to Villa, though, you broke into the England squad. You went to a World Cup in that first year.
Yeah.
So when that turning point of the manager having his meeting with you and you not taking that so well, for being so strong at Liverpool as a kid, yeah, breaking your leg three times, coming back from those injuries and those setbacks, how did that turn so much for you to let that affect you at that stage?
When I was at Liverpool, I was like the up-and-coming child. So I was the one that everyone was thinking, he's got a chance of making it. And there was a group of us, a small group of us, but I always felt like I was just at the tip of it because I thought my mentality was better and I'd sacrifice more to get there. So when I was at Liverpool, I was like the almost like the golden child who everyone's like pushing and pushing. So you get confidence from that. Mm. Then I get in the first team. That happens with Rafa. Confidence goes. Then you get a phone call, Mark Hughes. Mark Hughes goes, "Nah, I want you at Blackburn." Confidence goes back up again. Walk into the changing room. And I remember sitting down with Mark Hughes and he went, "I've done my background on you." He was like, "I know like everything about you, your attitude." Craig Bellamy had spoke to him because me and Bellas were together at Liverpool. And he went, "You've got to sign him. He's exactly the type of player that you'll need." So confidence goes up. But every manager that came in, I was either captain or vice captain of the team. So when Ryan Nelson wasn't playing, I was captain. Well, your confidence just keeps on going up and up. Then I went to Villa, Martin O'Neill, and I was just first half a season until that chat, I was on the trajectory of still going up. Then that chat happens and I just go, bumf, go downhill and think, well, how do I get back up? Because no one's given me that affirmation and going, you're a good player. Suddenly he's just told me I'm not doing well and I'm gone nosedived. He comes, he leaves in the at the end of the season, does, or the start of next season after, was it a week before the start of the season? Kev McDonald goes in as manager. I loved Kev, got on really well with Kev, played well. Then we get told Gerard Houllier's coming in. Well, Gerard Houllier at Liverpool didn't like me, didn't want me as a player, tried to get me out a couple of times. So suddenly I go down again and we had a run-in about an incident where, again, I'd love to have known that, but he's obviously passed away now. So again, go downhill. And then Alex McLeish comes in and Alex goes, "No, love you, want you as back as a player." And you go back up again.
What could you have done to keep yourself more in the middle, just not letting them...
Yeah, just, again, working with a psychologist, working closely with a psychologist and understanding what they're trying to get out of you and what they're trying to see. So, but the thing is, there's sometimes things out of your control. So the part with Gerard Houllier was, like, there was a lot of lads travelling at the time, wasn't there? I was in the Northwest and I'd travel into Villa, but I'd stay over three or four times a week. And when we had days off or the weekend, finished the game, I'd go home and he was like adamant that he wanted me to move. And I was like, well, kids are in school. Like, I'll review it again in January, but I'll move in January. And he was like, no. Oh no, he said, no, that's okay. And he said, but when we play away from home in the Northwest, he said, you don't have to ask me if you want to go home. You can just go home. He said, there's you, Brad and Emil, Brad Friedel and Emil Heskey. So I was like, right, okay. We played City away. I gave a penalty away in the game. And then after the game, loads of the lads went on a night out in Manchester, I think it was. And they didn't ask if they could go home. They just got off the bus and went. And when we came in on the Monday or the Monday, he was furious and he wanted an apology off everyone. And then he was asking me for an apology. I was like, I've got nothing to apologise. You told me I could go home. I didn't tell you this. And it was just like something flipped in him where he just got fed up with me. And I was like, and then I tried to sit down with him and have discussions and try and change the situation. He was like, no, you're done. That's you done. And that, like, that's the one thing I hate about football is like, opinions are very much like, once you're out of that manager's mind or in the manager's mind, you're done as a player. You can't reverse that. And it's like, well, I may as well have just left. And I couldn't get out the club. And then Liverpool came in for me. Kenny Dalglish was manager. He wanted me to go back to Liverpool. And Houllier stopped the move. And I resented him even more then. And I was like, why would you stop me going back to Liverpool? They got themselves a nice loan fee to take me back there. And I'd said to Liverpool, I'll take half my wages. I just wanted to go and play football. And the deal had been agreed. And then right at the last hour, cut it.
Are you mentally retired at this point?
Because yeah, that's massively. A lot. Done. Absolutely done. And it's hard as well when you're trying to deal with that. I came in for under Gerard Houllier, like Kev McDonald. If I hadn't have had Kev as a coach, I'd have jacked it. I'd have absolutely jacked it. He kept me going.
A great guy, wouldn't he, Kev?
Every single day. his thing would be to me, this will change. This will change for you. You've got to stay fit and someone will come and get you and they'll take you out of this. And I remember thinking, right, okay. And then I got a phone call to go on loan to Bolton. And I remember thinking, that was under Paul Lambert. Sorry. No, that was Houllier. And then I remember being in the same situation when Paul Lambert came into the club. And then I got a phone call in the summer to say that I was no longer wanted at the football club and to find myself another club. And I thought, to that, I'm not having it. Like, I'm not leaving without a fight. So I went away, came back the fittest I've ever been, ran over the top of everyone in pre-season. And he was just like, this is the attitude. This is how you respond to things. And I was thinking, I'm winning over here. Went to America, played every game, come back, had a game against Forest, jet lagged the week before the season, and came back in on the Monday. And he went, that's you done. And I was like, what? And he was like, I told you in the summer, you're not needed. I was like, have you just took me to all these places for them? Why have you not tried to push me out the door or sit me down every week and go, where are we up to? Have you got a move yet? It was like, he was dangling a carrot and I was like trying to get at it all the time. And then the week before the season, I was like, wow. And then I ended up sitting in the reserves again with Kev.
What did you think retirement would look like and what did it actually look like?
To be honest with you, I thought it was going to be great. I thought I was just going to enjoy a nice, relaxed life and sort of... I didn't know what to expect from it, if I'm being completely honest. And within the first 2 months or 2 or 3 months, I remember thinking, where's the structure gone? Where's that daily routine gone that I need? And I was like, holy shit, this is completely different. Because although I had the media work was, if you think about football now, we don't train to go to a game. We literally turn up on a Saturday, a Sunday, or a Tuesday and a Wednesday night. So you've got all them days free during the week. You've got so much time on your own. And I just remember thinking, I need more structure in my life here. And I found it very difficult. And that's where I sort of started to break down then and found life very difficult. The thing when you're talking before about your teammates and things like that, your teammates don't know what position you're in because some of them are still playing. I always think the lads who retire should become more of a community. And I think there's an element where the PFA, 100% the PFA should be ringing around the players a year, 2 years before they're going to retire. What's your plans? What are you thinking? And meet up with other players. Now, some will not want that. They'll say, I don't need that. But then at some point it'll hit them where they go, do you know that meeting that you offered us? Can I go to one of those meetings? Because it's completely different to what you think it's going to be. And you do need help and you need a sense of direction, a sense of purpose more than anything, because suddenly you've been someone who's needed within a team or within a structure to suddenly just being surplus to requirements and what's your worth in life then. Suddenly you're like, I don't know what to do with myself.
You are also one of the, I say few footballers I've heard talk about it so openly, and it's a very much a positive thing. You've discussed the fact that you started to struggle mentally late 2020, early 2021.
Yeah.
What did the depression feel like to you?
Just that you can't get out of it. There's nothing at the end of it where you're thinking, oh, this will change, this will turn. And you're thinking, I'm just stuck in a rut. I'd sit round all day, wouldn't move, just wouldn't get out, wouldn't do anything. I was going through problems at home with my ex-wife. I was then going through a divorce and things were very difficult, and that was my fault as well, because I was the one who wanted to step away from the marriage. I just wasn't happy at home. I think it's a very difficult thing to come to terms with as well. I remember once I was going through the divorce and I'd stepped away from the house and suddenly COVID hit and you're on your own completely. That was hard. You're in a room and you're thinking, you're used to noise in the house. I've got two kids. I was used to kids running around and doting on them all the time and things like that. And suddenly you sat there and you're on your own thinking, God, this is very, very strange. And I just got deeper and deeper into a rut. And I remember going to my brother's one night, who lived not far from where I used to live. And I'd moved from the local town where I was living into Liverpool city centre. And I just remember getting on the train one night, heading back, and I had my head in my hands, sort of just thinking, what the f*** am I doing here? I don't know where I'm going, what where this is going to end. And then bumping into a friend in the station, and he was like, what are you doing here? It was, I remember it being like 10 o'clock at night. Like, why are you on the train at this time? Why are you in town? I sort of said, I've split up and ended up renting a flat in town. I'm living in Liverpool now. And he was like, do you want to go and get a drink? So we went and had a drink, sat down for about an hour and a half, just chatting, me chatting, him listening. And I just remember, the one thing I always remember was him saying to me was, you'll never be happy all the time. You've just got to find a way to be content. And I remember thinking like, I didn't think anything of it at the time. And then over the next couple of months, I remember thinking to myself, what did he mean by that? It just kept on going over in my head. What did he mean by being content? And anyway, I ended up ringing him and just saying, listen, I'm in a bad way here. Can we meet and have a chat? And he was doing a psychology degree at the time and working on with people. And I remember just sitting down with him and doing a session for like an hour. And within that hour, like, I was like, I know what I'm doing now. Literally, I was like, right, here we go. I'm absolutely fine. Not a problem. And ever since that first meeting, and I've said it before, like, he literally saved me. Like, literally, he probably doesn't even realise like how much he's helped me. To the point where I'm just like, it was just phenomenal. Like that buzz, that feeling when I got off the call, and I was just like, here we go. Right, now I know what I'm doing.
Paul Cope.
Yeah.
I couldn't really comprehend it, if I'm honest. Warnie was always bright, lively, right in the middle of all the banter and stuff in the changing room. So I'm listening to a podcast one day and then suddenly it takes a darker turn and Warnie's talking about, you know, potentially ending his own life. And I just was, you know, hit quite hard by that and couldn't really believe that, you know, it got that low. So I just reached out with a message, I think either a voice note or a text just to say, I hope you're all right, mate. Like, if you want to have a chat, then I'm here. And I don't think we do enough of that, the lads that retire, like, especially as how close you can get. You're with each other day in, day out within that squad and you're going through the same things together. But like we said earlier, as soon as you kind of leave that club, you feel like you've probably been a bit too busy if you're always reaching out to the boys and that. So
I think one of the big things is when I did that podcast, I had to think about a lot of things before I did it. So telling my kids that's the position I was in. Imagine telling your kids that you were thinking of taking your life and that. I remember sitting down with them and said, listen, I'm telling you because I want you to be open and honest at some point you're going to get low and you're going to feel bad in your life or whatever. And you've got to speak to people. The other thing is as well, is like, it was an element of, and this is something Kopey always used to say to me was like, you don't sit down with someone who hasn't been through it because they don't understand what you're going through. And when you listen, if you listen to that episode with Kopey and when we talk, he'd been through the same things. He'd been a high case lawyer. He'd had his own law firm. He'd been a big hitter. And then his marriage fell to pieces and things like that. And I was thinking, well, he's been down that path. So if you're going to speak to someone about that side of life, go and speak to someone who's been through it and who understands you. And every time I said something, he was like, I know exactly what you mean. And I was thinking, but do you? And then he'd go, yeah, because of this, this and this. And I'd be like, he has as well. It was a relief from my point of view that someone else had been through it. And I was looking at him thinking, well, he's enjoying life again.
How old were your kids when you told them that? And how did that conversation go?
They were, what were they being now? So 17 and 19 now. So they were probably like 14, like 13 and 14, 12 and 14. Sobbed, all of us, crying. Just like, don't ever do that and don't ever think it's like that bad and that things like that. But that's a difficult conversation to have. That's one of the most awkward things I've ever had to do. But I remember when like Kopey said to me, like how to approach it. And this is what I approach a lot of things with now is a vulnerability to be open. The more vulnerable you are, the more easier it is to come across and to explain yourself. And yeah, it's not a nice thing to do, but I'd hope that the kids could talk to me about anything by being as open and as honest and as vulnerable as you can be.
When you were talking about how managers treat you and how teammates potentially treat you as well, I wonder now, everything you've been through, when you hear from fans, because you do a lot of media work, whether it's good or bad on social media, a lot of it's bad, or feedback from your bosses now, how do you take that these days?
Well, I don't listen to social media. Have you ever sat in a pub and watched a football match and listened to people talk about football?
They don't know what they're talking about. Is that what you're saying?
Well, some people do, but there's a lot who don't. And there's a lot who don't see things that we see.
Mm.
And it's like, it's interesting because sometimes I'll sit with friends and they're like, what are you watching? And I'm watching something completely different to what they're seeing. Some people have got a voice now, haven't they, on social media, and they want attention and things like that. And that's absolutely fine. But I remember sitting down with Kelly Cates, who's like presenter on Sky Sports and Match of the Day and things like that. And she was having a really tough time with it. People were having a pop at her for various like reasons and things like that. And she turned everything off on social media, all the replies and comments and things like that, and just took it out of her headspace. And I remember like sitting down with her and I was like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. So she was like, yep, push your phone, turned all the notifications off. And I was like, yeah, that's great, isn't it? So I don't listen to anyone. I value the opinions of people within the industry and people who I respect. And that's what I think you should do, because they hire you for a reason. Without being big-headed, I've been in the industry for now, 7 or 8 years. If I wasn't doing my job properly, I wouldn't get hired. So I think what I'm doing at the moment is obviously enough to please my bosses. So all I'll do when I do work with either BBC, NBC or whoever it might be is, if I'm working with a commentator, I will say to them after the game, if you can give me any feedback, how to improve, like I want to get better. I want to get better. So please, if you can give me that information, and I'll say it to my bosses at work as well. But the thing is that I know it's not I know it's not said in the wrong way. It's to help the channel. It's to help me to improve. So I don't take it personally. I just think, okay, yeah, I understand that and I will get better. But again, that comes with maturity and understanding things and working on like yourself to not take things to heart. One of the things is, and this is a decision I had to make when I went into this industry, is what type of pundit you want to be. So do you want to be a controversial one? Do you want to be one that sits on the fence, or do you want to be an informative one? And I thought, well, I'd like to be an informative one. I'd like to be someone that looks at a game tactically and sees things. And this changed for me when I was working. I remember thinking, it took me a while to get to where I wanted to be, but I had a general idea of like, I want to be informative and I want to see things from a tactical point of view and teach people. And I remember being on doing a game with Ian Dennis at Five Live, and I was doing hours upon hours of stats. And he looked at me book and he went, what's all that? So I was like, they're all my stats. And he was like, yeah, great. He went, look, that's mine. He went, exactly the same. He went, that's my job. And I was like, all right, okay. He went, your job, and he went, is to take every listener and viewer onto that pitch. And he went, we haven't been on it. And I was like, all right, okay. And he went, and then at halftime and full time, or before the game, take us in the changing room. What's the manager doing? What's the player doing? If things aren't going right on a pitch, how can they be corrected? What can they do differently for both teams? And I remember walking away from it thinking, that's different. And I changed completely. And I was like, right, that's what I'm going to do. So when I do my research now, like I often worry about this when I turn up to games, because I'll turn up and I'll literally write the teams down. I don't look at anything else because I've watched all the other games. And I just watch the game and I go, well, they're playing that. They're playing that. That's how you counteract that. That's how you change that. If you wanted to score, you'd do that. And I just think, right, so if that next game I'm going to do, I'd be thinking, well, in the previous game, that's what they did. And I'd just be thinking off previous games and things like that. And I often worry that people go, he hasn't done his research. When I turn up to games and people are like looking at me notes and I've just got the team sheets written down. But I just see things on the pitch that I react to and think, well, I know what I'm talking about in that situation. But I often do think like people are looking going, he's done no work here. But the telly in my house is constantly, or like I'm always on my phone watching clips of games and watching players and trying to learn about
like a profession for you now.
Yeah, massively. Yeah, because I just think if you don't do it, and I will get found out. Listen, there's certain things that you might say or do, and you look back and think, well, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. You should learn from it and get on with it.
And crucially, you know how to handle Chris Sutton, which I listened back on one of the Monday shows. Can I just ask to round off the chat we were having, for those that are listening or watching and are struggling at home, like, what are the biggest steps you've taken over the last 5 years? And what would you say?
Be aware of other people more than anything and what's going on with them. Not being all about me as much as you can, and more trying to think about others. I think one of the biggest things as well is, I don't do it as much now, and I probably should go back to it, but is writing things down. So if you've got something in your head, and it's something like when I was doing a podcast with Jamil a couple of weeks ago, we were also chatting about this, is like, you can write things down that you want to do, and then you can write how you want to approach it. So if you're fearful of something that's in the back of your mind and it's like constantly playing on your mind, we often just put it off and off and off. And there's an element where you've just got to go, right, I need to deal with that situation on this day, but this is how I'm going to approach it in a positive way, or in a way that, can it be better than I think it's going to go? And I often just try and write things down as much as possible. I used to keep a diary and I used to write in it every single day for probably over a year. And I stopped doing that. And I'd like to get back to it, but I feel like I'm in a better place, so I don't really need to go back to it full time. But trying to be honest with people as well. Don't leave things on your mind. If someone says something, I don't agree with it. Like my fiance now, she goes mad at me because I'm like the world's worst for it. If I don't like something someone said or someone's doing, I'll tell them. Because I get annoyed at myself if I walk off and go, I should have said something there. And I just think, just be open and honest. And if people don't like it, they don't like it. I think I used to be a people pleaser, whereas now I just think, just please you and the people around you.
I would say as well that working in this industry, and for someone who has anxiety and not many people are aware of it, I think the red light does a lot for you. Are you able to take that TV personality into real life settings? Because I feel like when you're on air, you forget about what's going on in your personal life.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, I do agree with that. Yeah, I think there's an element where, I mean, you listen to footballers and they say when you step over the white line, they pretty much forget everything and life becomes a lot easier on the pitch because it's what you know and it's what you do.
I hope you know how much you've helped people by speaking out, not just people in general, but football. Yeah, yeah. When you hear the name Stephen Warnock, what do you think?
Well, often I hear Neil Warnock because everyone calls me Neil. The amount of people who come up to me and they're like, Neil. And I'm like, Steve. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. So when I hear Steve, I'm actually quite pleased that people know my name. I don't know, to be honest with you. I think there's an element where I'd like to think now that people know me as the pundit and not the player. I think when you move from being a footballer into the pundit game, your relevance is there for a couple of years. So your name will carry for 2 or 3 years, but then you've got to become established as a pundit and being good at a pundit and what you do, because people will forget me. There's a lot of young lads now who'll go, who's he? I've never watched him play. Whereas hopefully people would turn on the telly and go, oh yeah, or listen to the radio and go, oh yeah, I know who he is. He's good at what he does on the telly or on the radio. And I respect his opinion, or I like his opinion, or don't agree with it sometimes, but on a whole, he's good at what he does. So for me, it's moving away from being a player and being now a pundit and starting a new career. I got the best advice from my dad when I was starting out in my career as a pundit. And he basically said to me at the start of it was, think of this first 2 years as your YTS. He was like, work anywhere for any price, get as many hours in as you can, make mistakes, work out what you want to be, and then go from there and you'll work it out. And I remember thinking, right, I'll do that. And I was working a lot of the time for no money. I was taking £50 jobs. It was just a case of working your way into the media and finding your way. So hopefully like sort of 6 years on from them 2 years of YTS, I've started to mould myself a nice enough career where things are working well enough and I'm busy enough and unfortunately I have been.
And now look at you flying on the More Than A Name podcast.
Yeah, I'm here.
Mr. TV, do you want to do the show closer for us?
What is it?
No research.
Yeah,
again.
No research.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, loved it.
And you're going to go to the gym now, you two?
Yeah, we're going to go and do a Barry's boot camp.
Barry's boot camp and then have a few drinks
and
after it.
And we've earned our beers then.
Sounds good. Brilliant. Well, thank you for joining us and thank you for watching and listening, guys. Remember, we're on social media at More Than A Name Pod. You can get in touch, morethananamepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you again next week.